On Life and Times on ABC Radio National this week, the last in our three-part series of Paradise Lost. Hello, I'm Sue Clark.
My God, there was a couple of vultures that lived on the top of a dead tree, and we used to play at being monkeys, and my elder brothers, Wallace and Norman and Ack, and various others, used to go off and pretend to be monkeys and chaka, 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 like the monkey sound. So I think I must have been six, went up after them, up the trees, but I had a dress on, and I missed one jump, and I landed on a dead branch by my skirt, and there I was hanging there. And Ack, my brother Ack, he said, "You silly fool, why did you jump that way?" And I said, "I was trying to jump like you." And so he had to climb out on the dead branch to get me down and lower me down, because there were lots of creepers down below, you see. Anyway, we got safely down, no bones broken. It was a lovely life on Cosne. I enjoyed it. I have no regrets.
Rose Memuir, one of the two surviving originals of the Cosme colony, talking to Anne Whitehead, who recorded and presented this series for the Social History Unit in 1990. And as we've heard, in 1892, after the Queensland shearers' strike, some 500 people followed William Lane to Paraguay. Their intention was to establish a socialist settlement, a kind of working man's paradise. But soon enough, there was trouble in paradise, and Lane and 60 of his followers moved away and started a new colony in Cosme. Now, whatever political differences divided the adult Australians, for the children, it really was a paradise. Rose was one of the eight offspring of William and Lillian Wood. For her brothers, Bill and Norman, it was the magic of the evenings in the social hall that they remembered.
And they had a piano and an accordion. Jack Black, I remember, was a splendid accordionist. My dad used to be able to grind out the dance music also, make things lively. All the movements of the quadrilles they danced, first set.
Promenade lances. For the first set, promenade for the Lancers, promenade for the Alberts, and the Caledonians. And there are various others.
These square dances, they call them, were very complicated things. Every movement, the movement, shall we say, would last till a couple of minutes, I suppose, and then another time would be introduced into the music, and they'd do something else, like Chain, they'd call it, wasn't it?
Ladies Chain Double Etty. Ladies Chain Double Etty. And the first couple would dance and bow, retire and bow, and the next couple does the same thing, and then all swing.
Not everybody was a dancer, but of course they had seats all round the floor on the sides. They could sit there and chat together. And about 8 or 9 o'clock in the evening, they'd light a bonfire at the back of the hall, put on two or three drums of water to boil, and make the Paraguayan tea, mate cocido, in these, and every housewife would bring sandwiches or a cake. Everybody contributed something for eating. everybody seemed to thrive on the interval, as we used to call it. We kids grew up thinking that interval meant something to eat.
Was there Paraguayan food on the table?
Well,
apart from the mate?
They didn't come to our dances, not in the time it was a colony anyway.
In the early days, you didn't have any Paraguayan music or Paraguayan dances?
No, it was all English, all English. The ones that weren't interested in the dance, they would go up onto the... There was a 30-inch addition to the dance floor, about a 10 by 10 meter wooden floor that used to be a stage for any play they put on. They had to be able to draw a curtain quite across, and the stage would be used, like I suppose any other theatre, to change scenes and everything. But if the men that weren't dancing would get up on there and tables, chairs, and play chess and drafts till the dance was finished.
Well, did I ever tell you about when we had a fancy dress ball? I think I must have been about 12 then, and I went as Mary, Mary, quite contrary, how does your garden grow? And I had a little basket with a little bit of flour, but I was a roly-poly little fat thing, and Kathy was, my sister was thin and fairy-like, and so she went with wings on her shoulders as a little fairy. And old Jimmy Symes, he went as Robinson Crusoe, and he had a sheepskin front and a sheepskin on his back and a straw thatched umbrella. And he was Robinson Crusoe. I think it's funny. And Mum went as Queen of the Night, and she was dressed all in black with those firefly beetles under a net on her hair.
The women used to have a collection of small safety pins, and I don't suppose the fire beetles appreciated it, but it was quite a spectacle seeing women walking around with these beetles shining in their hair. Cosme Social Hall was more or less the central part of the colony. Everybody could come in from round about, shall we say. They not only had dances, but plays from Shakespeare, and also for the children, the Kinderspiel, Little Boy Blue, and Jack and the Beanstalk, and plays like that where the kids could all take part. I remember I was Jack of Jack and the Beanstalk. I had to sing. I don't know how I managed it, because I haven't been able to sing at all my life. But I had to sing a doleful sort of a dirge about my mother and I have of late felt poverty's pinch once or twice. But they had Shakespeare's plays, some of them put on with, of course, all the adults that were the highbrow community that wrote the notes, Cosme notes. And they would also have recitals, like people reciting poems. And even I, on one marvelous occasion, read a story out of Chums, which was an English boys' paper that was produced in England. And there was a blood-curdling tale about a boy travelling out into the grasslands on his own. And he was suddenly attacked by a furious mob of wild pigs. I was sent up to Jimmy Symes to what do they call it, tutor me on the reading of it, not to sort of get too excited about what I was reading and read it properly to the large audience. When he assured us that I could go and read it in the first full moon social, I went up on the stage and read this very spicy or exciting boy's yarn. It stuck in my memory about that boy getting chased up the tree with a horde of pigs.
The funny thing about it, I think, is that that would have been wild fantasy for children reading it in England. but you were living in that sort of thing.
Yes, that's best.
I remember my first schoolmaster was John Lane. And Bill said a lot of the pupils used to go and sit around shooting marbles or something like that. But with John Lane, there was nothing like that. If you didn't go to school, he would be after you to your mother and say, where's Ack? Alec didn't turn up for school. So my mother would go and look for me. Well, that day that I'm remembering, I was visiting with my friend Dave McLeod. And he saw my mother coming, so he said, get behind the door. I got behind the door. And that she came in and pulled the door back and saw me, and took me home. And then away to school. And when I got there, John Lane gave me a cup with a cane and he said, don't do it again. My mother gave me a belting, and when your father comes home, she said, you'll wait for him in that room. And I got it all right in the neck. There was very good discipline in John Lane's school. He was a disciplinarian. He taught very well, I always thought. But his heart was in Australia, I think. That's my opinion.
We had a teacher called Mr. Groves, and he thought he would teach us botany. And so he took the class into the forest to teach us botany. He may have taught the elder boys botany, but he certainly didn't teach me botany, because I held a twig back and let it go and hit him in the face. Poor man, he said, Rosie, you shouldn't have done that. I said, but I thought you were teaching us botany.
He didn't like the practical part.
And I suppose he didn't really understand the Paraguayan plants anyway. He came from England.
Did you learn the names of the Paraguayan trees and plants as you went along?
Only a few, very few, because we lived just on Cosme, and the boys went out and around about and spoke Guarani, but we stayed home close to, because all the girls had, the boys finished school before lunch, and we had to return at 2 o'clock to learn sewing, embroidery, crochet, and knitting, and from 2 to 4. So we didn't have much opportunity to get out and about and see things.
Were you cross about that?
Not at all. I enjoyed it. I thoroughly enjoyed it. And I won some prizes in my embroidery and my sewing. When I was 10, Miss Nemo came to teach us. She used to read aloud to us. And that's where I learned about Black Beauty, that horse. Miss Nemo, the tears ran down her eyes when she read aloud how poor Black Beauty had been maltreated.
Miss Nimmo was a Church of England woman, very much a church woman. She used to teach us to pray, and she'd read the Bible every day and have a certain number of prayers that had to be said, sung hymns. I knew practically all the hymns in the hymn book without looking at them. And she taught us quite well. We had to uphold the empire in those days. And we'd been at school with English people. They taught us all the counties. I knew them all by heart, the capitals of each county and the rivers upon which they were built, on the river so-and-so. Winchester on the Itchen. That was Hampshire, I think. No, they didn't teach us much about Paraguay. I had to do some history of Paraguay, but very little. We knew about the Paraguayan War with the Triple Alliance. But it wasn't very popular with our masters. They wanted to teach us about England. And one Englishman gave me a map of England with London and a slide rule to see how far each town was from London. So I knew it all.
Well, the thing is, on Cosme, there were long periods when there was no real teacher, so the children there didn't really go to school. They just went to the house, which was called the school, and sat there playing or amusing themselves instead of learning something.
We were absolutely free, except when we were getting home at night, we began to worry about the belting we were going to get. We were out all day, practically. I was standing on the brink of one of these gullies with another little boy, and we saw a wild pig come down near us, went down into the gully and sat in a water hole, and then it saw us, and it came up our way, I suppose, went back on its own track. And I pushed the little boy up a tree, and then I jumped for another tree. And after the pig had gone, I found this tree was all prickles. I didn't feel anything. I was so afraid of this pig. Climbed up a prickly tree. Were you there when Mum dragged that snake out of the hole in the floor and killed it with her slipper?
But that was down on the flat before the...
No, it wasn't. It was up on the hill.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, a big yellow snake, a very poisonous sort of snake. He was trying to swallow a frog. And she found him, and when the snake saw her, he dropped the frog and went to get into his hole. Mum caught it by the tail and drawing it out and hitting it with a slipper until she killed it. Then she she put the frog in front of it and said, "Now you look at that."
Was it a boa constrictor sort of snake?
No, it was a poisonous snake, yellow one.
Yellow belly.
This is the one that I was telling you that bit Rose, went charging around playing in the sugarcane patch. The snake bit her. It was the one of the most poisonous snakes in Paraguay.
At the age of 9, a snake bit me. I was in the cane patch of Rod McLeod's. That was the last cane patch on Cosme. And we kids were trotting along, enjoying ourselves, trying to be pigs in the cane patch. And apparently the day before, they had killed the mate. Then the mate bit me, and I went trotting home to Mum, and I said, "Mummy, a snake bit me." And Mum, of course, came from Queensland. And so she sent to Mrs. Lawrence, who was a nurse in Queensland. She sent Kathy up to call Mrs. Lawrence, and Mrs. Lawrence said, "We must give her the juice of banana. That will cure snakes." And Sir Norman, my brother, he used to cut the little bits of new banana and put it through the mincer and save the juice. Ooh, but that juice was a terrible taste. I cried every time I had to take it. But I recovered. I woke up. I lost consciousness, of course, but I woke up with a terrible stink under my nose. And I said, "Mummy, take this stink from under my nose." And she took that cloth from under. It was dirty blood, stinking blood. And she kept changing the cloth so long as I bled. But apparently that saved my life, that the dirty blood came out of my veins. And years later I asked my brother, "Why didn't I die?" And he said, "The snake only got one fang into you. He didn't get the second fang into you. Otherwise you would have died." I want you to see that the snake trouble is still here. Sometimes this side, it feels as if worms are crawling in here.
On your foot there?
There. Mm. That, you see, is completely different from this foot.
Yes, completely. Mm. Completely. You've got bruise marks.
You see, it's all here, and this is completely puffed up, this whole part, and it's as sensitive as anything.
And that was about 76 years ago?
When I was 9.
The next generation of children from the colony had the chance at an education and experience of a wider world than their parents. But what many of them still remember most vividly, like Bill Wood's daughter Florence, are those carefree wild days growing up at Cosme.
The most enjoyable part, I think, of our childhood on Colony Cosme is that there were no restrictions, and there were always wonderful fruit, and you can go into anybody's patches of melons or watermelons and just eat them without even permission, or climbing very difficulty because you cannot climb a banana tree, but somehow we children could, and climbing banana trees and cutting down green bananas and eating green bananas and then getting terribly sick and doing all kind of things like that, and going fishing and swimming in the Capivari, going to the Stony Crossing and going over and seeing this marvelous clean water of the Capivari. We didn't swim very good, but we were never afraid. And just riding on horses bareback with no saddle, no nothing, and just, you know how it's like Tom Sawyer, but in a different time.
On ABC Radio National's Life and Times, you're listening to Paradise Lost, which was recorded and presented by Anne Whitehead in August of 1990.
We'll clap our little hands and shake our little feet. Oh my, but Cosmic Corn is sweet. Oh folks, they must be naughty when they call it nigger meat. Oh my, but corn is good to eat.
But Cosme's corn was not sweet enough. It couldn't prevent the collapse of the little socialist colony in Paraguay, which had been set up in 1894 with such idealistic fervour. Its founder, William Lane, left 5 years later, bitter at the failure of his dreams. From there on, it was a long, slow decline. The settlers had gone to Paraguay to escape the corruption of the world, but they'd carried the seeds of dissent and corruption within them. There were so many ironies. The Paraguayan government had granted the Australians land because it needed new bloodstock. Its population had been ravaged by a genocidal war. They reportedly went from a population of 525,000 to 220,000, and of that, only 28,000 were adult men. And the Paraguayan government was unaware that one of the pledges the Cosme colony had signed was the preservation of the colour line. Racial mixing was strictly forbidden, a sore point for the colony's overwhelming number of bachelors who couldn't even drown their frustration with alcohol. That was banned too. Another contradiction was that the colonists proclaimed they'd left the class system behind, but new caste structures had emerged, the intellectuals and the labourers, and the chronic factor always there, causing dissension and bitterness among the few families hanging on, was the grinding poverty of their lifestyle.
You plant sugar cane and make sugar, who are you going to sell to? And the Cosme people didn't know how to go about making money. They were getting further into debt. I think one of the reasons, nobody knew the language, one of the reasons. And my mother never learned Spanish all the years she was here. She never learned Spanish. A little bit. She knew my father used to try and speak Guarani, but he couldn't manage it. He spoke quite well Spanish, but not Guarani.
The young people who were thinking of women, they didn't have the language to go out and mix with these. So, for example, Alec Lewis's sons, Charlie and Rod, I remember when I was 7 or 8, they seemed to be young 20-year-olds, and no doubt they had ideas of what they'd like to get away to some civilized place where they could get a girl to talk to and fall in love with. That must have influenced the Lewis family, at least, to clear out from Cosme. And John Lane, who had been teaching on Cosme all the time he was on Cosme, he must have been rather worried about his girls also.
My sister Kathy was beautiful. She was a semi-blonde, more towards red, but she was beautiful and could dance like a fairy. And she was beautiful in every ways. And Antonio Cordos fell in love with Kathy. So he went to my father and said, "Don Guillermo, por favor, si puede asistir en con Catalina, I will give you my best bull." And my father was highly amused to think
that Kath was worth a first-class bull. And Kath's almost hit the roof.
I remember that on one Sunday, everybody had a sucking pig for lunch. And Alf Davy, who was in charge of the pigs, he pointed this one for us. And he said, "I'll kill it for you." And I said, "No, I'll take it home alive." Well, I took it home and I used to feed it. And it grew up, big pig like that. And that was after the divide, yes. But when they killed it, all the other socios, the other partners, they all got a share of it also. And I said to my father, "But that's my pig." He said, "No, but we've got to share it with the, that's our way of life." And I said, "That is communism." Well, I said, "I'm not a communist. I won't be a communist."
You said the other socios.
Socios. Well, the other partners of the nine. They were formed of nine partners. And one was five partners, David Stevenson, Billy Lawrence, Alf Davy, Rod McLeod and James Syme. They were the five partners of the opposite. They were the majority. Our side was Alan McLeod, Billy Wood, Leonard Apthorpe and Ernest Kell. They were the four. They were in the minority. When the voting came up, they were minors.
Yes, I think it was about 1910 because I was 10 years old, and Jimmy Syme had got some money somehow or other, and he decided to give each child a number of pesos that the years corresponded to. I was 10 years old and he gave me a $10 bill. We called it a dollar, but it was a peso.
And how did the breakup happen?
Well, a lot of the hard workers were dissatisfied with the working of other members of the community, and also some of the men or the members of the community were single and they didn't see why they should be working the same as the next door man who had a family of 10. They and their wife on their own, and the other man had 10 children to keep. Well, they were eating all the food and he was producing his share of it. So there was some members of the community that weren't pulling their weight at all to provide money for the surveyor and for the lawyers. They had to sell the best part of Cosme, which was almost a complete forest land full of timber. They sold that to pay lawyers and the surveyor.
They had to sell Vizcaíno, which was the bigger half, to pay him, and what was left over from his charges, they divided among the nine. Now, Mr. Apthorpe, he lost his. He put it in a bank in Asunción, and the bank went bankrupt. Poor man, he lost everything. Dad had his in a different bank, and he lived on the proceeds, and I suppose the whole thing, until about 1916. After that, he'd eaten the whole lot away. Then he started selling things around that belonged to him.
So there was nothing to leave for you children?
Nothing at all.
Lane's Paraguay experiment and its eventual failure left a new generation of young people, children of the Australian colonists, stranded in Paraguay. Some of these first-generation migrants embraced the country of their birth with enthusiasm. Others, like the Wood brothers, were more confused about their heritage. With the outbreak of World War I, 10 Cosme men, including Bill, Alex and Norman Wood, enlisted in the British Army.
soldiers defending the empire they'd learned about at school. Bill was sent to Gallipoli, where he met Australians in large numbers for the first time. When I spoke with 90-year-old Norman Wood last year, he was still very moved by his brother's account of the Australian losses on that battlefield and by Henry Lawson's poem about Gallipoli.
The wireless tells and the cable tells how our boys behaved by the Dardanelles. Some thought in their hearts, will our boys make good? We knew them of old and we knew they would. Knew they would. We were mates of old and we knew they would. The cooey called through the Menai camp and an army roared like the ocean's tramp on a gale-swept beach in its wildest mood till the pyramids shook as we knew they would. Knew they would. And the Sphinx woke up as we knew they would. They were shipped like sheep when the dawn was grey, but the officers knew that no lambs were they. They squatted and perched where'er they could, and they blanketed for joy as we knew they would. Knew they would. They blanketed for joy as we knew they would. The sea was hell and the shore was hell, with wire entanglements, shrapnel and shell. But they stormed the heights, as Australians should, and they fought and they died as we knew they would. Knew they would. They fought and they died as we knew they would.
Someone hearing you reciting wouldn't believe that you'd never been to Australia.
They wouldn't believe that I'd been to Australia. Well, I haven't been to Australia, but we learned our language with a lot of Australians. We stuck to our Australian accent. And a fellow down in the Argentine told me that he couldn't believe that I wasn't an Australian. He thought I... On board the ship going to England, I said, Tucker, when I was talking with some people, I said, Tucker's ready or something. And the man jumped up and said, you're an Australian. I said, no. He said, that word Tucker is Australian. I said, I suppose it is. My father and mother were Australian, so I have a lot of Australian blood in me. I couldn't get into the way of talking of these English people. They had all sorts of accents and ways of saying the things. I always felt myself a stranger amongst them. I didn't get on with them.
You identified with Australians?
Yes. I even went to leave my kit bag at the Australian place in London. I wanted to deposit it there while I was doing something somewhere else. They say, why don't you go to your own people? This doesn't belong to the English army, this is Australia. I couldn't say I was Australian because I had an English uniform.
So, what do you call yourself? Do you call yourself a Paraguayan or an Australian Paraguayan or an Australian?
Well, I don't know what I call. I seem to be half English and half Paraguayan.
Not Australian in any way?
Not Australian, no. I'm not Australian, but I like Australia.
Whereas your brother, Bill, called himself Australian.
Well, he was Australian. He was born there. But I was born in Paraguay.
and the grandchildren of the pioneers, now mostly in their 40s and 50s, and a number of them highly successful in their chosen professions, are on the whole even more certain of their Paraguayan identity. But nonetheless, many of them admit to strong and complicated feelings about Australia and their curious socialist heritage.
People usually ask me, how do you get an English name? And I had to tell the story of my grandfather was Australian, and then they are fascinated about the group of Australians who came in the 1893, you said? 93 into Paraguay. So most of the people in Paraguay even ignore that the Australians who came here were socialists. They just think that they were immigrants like Germans, Polish, Italians, Spaniards, you see. But I know, and I'm very proud to know that they were, not because they were socialists, but because they were faithful to their ideal, you see. They took the idea of socialism, and they were faithful to that idea to the point of leaving their own country and coming to an unknown world and to unknown country and suffering so much because of their ideal, you see. So I feel very much close to the Australian, to the Australians, and I only feel sorry that we are so far away and so culturally isolated or separated from Australia.
We were always called Gringo Ra'u, which in Guarani means son of a gringo. And of course we were always wondering that our last name was Wood, not Gonzalez or Fernandez. So there comes a question when you go to your father and ask him about where the last name come from, because it was difficult for the people around us to pronounce it correctly, properly. They never said Wood, they said Bus, whatever, you know. But I would make myself at home if I happened to go to Australia right away, you know, because I don't have the same breakfast like the Paraguayans do during the winter time, because my father was always fixing us bacon and eggs. And the local people thought we were crazy having such a fat thing for breakfast. It's confusing. Sometimes you want to be a pure or a total member of the country that you were born. But to me, I know and I feel that it's not all here. It's something left there. It's in my blood, I would say, in my spirit.
John, you said that you don't want to see the colony now full of Paraguayans. Don't you see yourself as a Paraguayan?
We, in my aspect, I seem to think that I'm still a sort of a, let's say, more or less like an Australian descendant, rather than a Paraguayan. I never mixed much with the Paraguayan. So, I don't know, I think I have perhaps 10% Paraguayan and 90% still, let's say, Australian.
When you were growing up, do you think things were different for you in any way because of having an Australian ancestry?
I don't think as you grow up you're very happy being different from your friends and from people who surround you, because you always are on somebody's, they're watching you and they want to know why you're different, and especially me, being a redhead and freckled. In the whole country, there were only two girls, redheaded and freckled, when I was young. So it was, for me, it was an embarrassment. And I wish they called me gringa, which was a very derogative term. And I was never happy when I was young of being different. Now I don't mind and I'm happy what I am, but I had to learn to really accept that. I never thought of myself an Australian. And I never think of myself an Australian. I always think of myself as a Paraguayan. Now I'm more aware, you know, with the books and the movies and things, what's going on. And, you know, I admire them terribly. And I think Australians are lovely people. Everybody whom I met, I really have a feeling of that I like them, but I feel that I'm just real Paraguayan. As a matter of fact, my father, whom I admire terribly, and I think he made it possible that I accepted what I was, and I should really be happy that I had other culture and that I knew English, that that would help me a lot in life. He said that Australians were always truthful and really sincere people and noble people, and, you know, he always tried to make all of us in the family feel that we were very fortunate to have these two cultures. But on top of that all, I feel totally that my heart really belongs to Paraguay. But I have a very Australian mind, and I have a very Paraguayan heart.
What's an Australian mind? What's a Paraguayan heart?
Paraguayan hearts are very gentle, very romantic, and Paraguayans are very noble people, and they are open to anybody. They would very hospitable. They would give anybody. They love people and things like that. And my brain, I think, is more, I don't know if it's Australian or English, but I think more with a different brain, because I'm very, I have to measure everything, my actions. I measure things before I do things. Whereupon Paraguayan goes straight into it. I'm a woman, but I have probably, in the Paraguayan term, I have a man's mind. Men don't like that here. They want to be the ones who are in command, and I have a very, I'm very opinionated and strong-willed, and that has to be a man here in Paraguay. A woman has to be very gentle and docile and go along with what they say, and I'm on the contrary, and that's why I could never find a Paraguayan husband. I found boyfriends, but when they had to clash with my mind, it was a goodbye, and that was it. That was it.
My journey through Paraguay ended with a final interview with Florence's uncle, Norman Wood. At 90 years of age, he is the patriarch of the Australian Cosme descendants. It was unseasonably cold in the northern river town of Concepcion, where he lives, and as we talked, we huddled in his kitchen by a crackling fuel stove.
So is Cosme today very different to the old days?
No, there's nobody left there now except Roddy McLeod, but I think he died lately. And our nephew, Frisky, he has not done too badly. The only man who made a success of Cosme is our nephew, Frisky. He has two trucks, and he works for the timber. He goes out shooting partridges when he has a day off. Yes, Cosme. The only attraction there is a cemetery where I could go and see the graves of all those people who are dead. My dad and my mother, Mrs. Black, Mrs. McLeod, Rod McLeod, Roddy McLeod, Eddie McLeod, Colin McLeod, Mr. Collins.
Your brother Wallace?
Yes, Wallace is there.
There's a lot of dreams and hopes buried in that little cemetery?
They lost them pretty quickly, I think, and they couldn't get back. It's a wonder to me how they could believe in a man like William Lane. He must have been a bit mad.
But your father wasn't?
He wasn't mad, but he was. He'd promised, and he wanted to keep his promise, so he came. But he promised rashly. He shouldn't have done that. He could have been better off in Australia, although he said if I'd stayed in Australia, I would have been dead by now. A short life, but a merry one.
Well, you're going strong. I look forward to coming back for your 100th birthday.
I don't pretend to be so long living. And neither am I thinking of being time to die.
So we'll put another log of wood on the fire.
It's good and warm in here. You might tell them that it's cold outside. I've always wanted to go to Australia, but now I'm satisfied to stay here and finish my life in Paraguay. I'm quite all right. I don't have any need for very much. I can live on what I've got, and I can help people. I have my family, quite a big one, as a matter of fact, and they all gather around whenever there's any trouble. I am well protected. I have a wife who is a Paraguayan. A good woman. She has never been annoyed with me, not on any occasion. She has given me 7 children, 6 boys and a girl. They somehow or other like and respect me. We're a united family. I have friends here in town. If you want to write to me, you say on the address Norman Wood, Concepcion, Paraguay, and that is enough. There are a lot of people in Concepcion, but the postmistress knows me, and she sends my letters up here. If you put that address on them.
I think you'll get a lot of letters.
I don't think so. If there's no interest, they won't write.
John Norman, thank you very much.
Don't mention it.
When this series, which was recorded and presented by Anne Whitehead, first went to air in 1990, dozens of ABC Radio National listeners did write to him. And you know what? Norman replied to every single letter. Sadly, he died in April 1992, aged 93. Now, the Henry Lawson poem that he recited was Song of the Dardanelles, and you can find a link to that poem, hear this program again, or find more information on Anne's book, Paradise Mislaid, In Search of the Australian Tribe of Paraguay, which won the New South Wales Premier's Australian History Prize in 1998, on our website, abc.net.au/rn/lifeandtimes. Just before I go, a very big thank you to Mary Jane Field, who arranged the wonderful music that you've heard in this series, and to the original producers, Jenny Palmer and Jill Lennon. I'm Sue Clark, and until next time, bye for now.